First Kings chapter 18. First Kings chapter 18. As we continue our series through this very exciting ministry of Elijah, and today's passage does not disappoint. Who is the greatest? Who is supreme? That question is the theme, as you know, of countless dramas of our age, and really of every age, from ridiculous superhero debates like Batman and Superman, Thanos and the Avengers, and if you don't know what that means, you're fine, to hypothetical debates about various figures in the sports, Ali and Frazier, Jordan, LeBron. Who is the greatest? It's something that we're drawn to, defining the greatest. And then more serious contests of supremacy take place all throughout history, from the Peloponnesian Wars to the drama of Hannibal and the elephants to the shipwreck of the Spanish Armada, to the global wars of the 20th century, to even as of this weekend, missiles and defense capabilities and wars and rumors of wars. There are always these questions: who is supreme? And all of those debates, I believe all of those, from the silly and spurious to the very serious and deadly, all of those debates ultimately are echoes of the ultimate version. Who is supreme over all things? Or to use biblical language, who is God? Who is God? Who is the one true God? And not just one among many, who is the ultimate one? Who is the one true God? And this passage we're about to read, it forces upon us the question throughout the generations: who do you believe is the one true God, and what difference does that make in your life? Who do you believe is the one true God, and what difference does that make in your life? I'm going to tell the entirety of this chapter in three sections, all right? There's three sections which we could caption: the confrontation, the fire, and the rain, okay? So we'll just walk through. I'm going to read one section at a time so that we leave the suspense of the story to the very end, the final selection. But let's begin reading in chapter 18 and verse 1, this section I might caption the confrontation. After many days, the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now, the famine was severe in Samaria, and Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now, Obadiah feared the Lord greatly. And when Jezebel, that's Ahab's wife, the queen, when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by fifties in a cave and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we may find grass and save the horses and mules alive and not lose some of the animals." So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah went in another direction by himself. And as Obadiah was on the way, behold, Elijah met him. And Obadiah recognized him and fell on his face and said, "Is it you, my lord Elijah?" And he answered him, "It is I. Go tell your lord, behold, Elijah is here." And he said, how have I sinned that you would give your servant into the hand of Ahab to kill me? As the Lord your God lives, there is no nation or kingdom where my Lord has not sent to seek you. And when they would say he is not here, he would take an oath of the kingdom or nation that they had not found you. And now you say, go and tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. As soon as I have gone from you, the Spirit of the Lord will carry you I know not where. And so when I come and tell Ahab and he cannot find you, he will kill me. Although I, your servant, have feared the Lord from my youth. Has it not been told, my Lord, what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord, how I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50s in a cave and fed them with bread and water? And now you say, go tell your Lord, behold, Elijah is here. He will kill me. And Elijah said, as the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself to him today. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, is it you, you troubler of Israel? And he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but you have, and your father's house, because you have abandoned the commandments of the Lord and followed the Baals. Now therefore send and gather all Israel to me at Mount Carmel, and the 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. Lord, bless the preaching and the believing of your word. Scene one of three, the confrontation. We're brought into the moment when the drought has been lasting for 3 years, the drought that Elijah prayed for to reveal the impotency of Baal, the false god, who is supposed to be the god of rain and thunder and lightning, and yet God withholds rain as a direct assault on his claim to supremacy. This drought has been going on, and God decides now is the time for confrontation. So he tells Elijah, go show yourself to Ahab. And the famine, as you note in verse 2, is severe in Samaria. Now, we're introduced into this man somewhat randomly called Obadiah. And he actually gets a somewhat lengthy description. It's referenced twice that in spite of the idolatry of the king and the obvious temper of the king, this man was willing to hide prophets of the Lord and to sustain them in this season. Generally, we get a very favorable view of this man. I think that Obadiah in this passage is in some ways a foil, if you know that term literally. It's a contrast to Ahab. And you can see that contrast throughout the passage. So Ahab is trying to basically kill Elijah, but Obadiah is providing for and watching out for prophets of the Lord. Ahab has no fear of the Lord. Obadiah, it says, fears the Lord greatly from his youth. Ahab wants to slaughter God's messenger, but Obadiah falls at his face to show him reverence. So there's a great contrast. You could even put it this way. Obadiah is the ruler that the kingdom really needs, and it reveals in contrast just how bad Ahab really is. Now, when Elijah tells Obadiah, I want you to go find your master and tell him to come here, Obadiah rightly, I don't think this is supposed to make him look bad, he rightly is revealing just how dangerous this king is. He's like, look, I know you prophet people, and the moment I leave here, the Spirit's going to carry you away, and you're going to go do some amazing thing. But I'm going to come back holding the hand of the king and say, I promise he was right here. And then what's going to happen is he's going to kill me. It's meant to reveal the extreme hatred of the king for God's prophet. That's really the thing it's meant to reveal. You have this godly man who's saying, let me just, here's the lay of the land. He hates you. He searched for you everywhere. He hasn't been able to find you. You also want to notice the contrast there, that the writer does this so well. Obadiah is led by the Lord and randomly bumps into Elijah when Ahab has been searching for him everywhere. And he can't find him, and his servant randomly walking up the road bumps into him. So after 3 years of hunting for a prophet, requiring promises, you have to swear that you don't have him in your territory, this servant finds him with apparently no trouble at all. So the whole passage is designed to show the absolute powerlessness of this man who has trusted in Baal. He can't find him, and his servant finds him. So I want you go find the king and bring him back here. And we see the point. God is determined now to bring this confrontation about. So Elijah, as the mouthpiece of the Lord, makes it very clear. I will surely, in verse 15, show myself to him today. He reassures Obadiah, this is the moment. I'm not going to put you in a vulnerable position. I'm not going to do that to you. This is the moment of confrontation. It is going to happen. One small note that I think it's worth learning from Obadiah. We won't linger on him, but he's worth meditation because he is a man who lives in the midst of an idolatrous and secular culture and is required at some level to do what he can to serve his master, the king, who's actually the king of the land, and yet at the same time to have a greater fear of the Lord. He's actually a wonderful study in what it looks like to serve in the midst of a secular culture. He's not called to be a prophet, and yet he does everything he can to serve a higher good of following the Lord. So he's a wonderful study and I think actually relevant for people today in various positions. He keeps the Lord's fear above all things, but it's not as though he doesn't serve in some way, serve his country and his king. A very, very helpful and brief and delightful actually study in what this man does. But for now, what he's doing is he's now being sent. Notice that the servant of Ahab is now the servant of Elijah. Notice the reversal that's beginning to take place. He is now being sent, and he summons the king. The king is now being summoned. You notice that? The king is now being summoned. The whole passage builds again and again on this theme of who's actually in control. And even these subtle and almost amusing ways in which God sets it up such that the king has to be summoned, he has to be sought after, like a little child. No, come over here. And so here he comes. And having been sought, we notice in verse 17, when Ahab sees Elijah, he calls out to him, "You troubler of Israel." You notice that in verse 17. And in one sense, he's right. Elijah prayed that God would send a drought. God responds to him. God sends a drought. It's God's plan. So in one sense, yes, he has brought the trouble of discipline on the land. And isn't it the case, isn't it always the case, that those who are worshiping idols, their greatest annoyance is the people who are calling them out? Isn't that always the case today? You know what's really bothersome is that you people won't just let us do whatever we want. That you're always talking about it. Why don't you just let us do whatever we want? That's essentially what Ahab says. You're the problem. You're the problem. And throughout the generations, not that everyone's Elijah, not that everyone's called to call for a drought, but the godly representatives are ironically the ones called out for being the troubler, when the reality is it's those that defy God that are actually troubling the land. It's often the case, and it's the case here, but Elijah is called to state the reality of things. I have not troubled Israel, not ultimately. You have, because you have rejected the Lord and have followed the Baals. That's what's going on actually. You're annoyed by my voice. You're annoyed by the discipline of the Lord. You don't like that. But the reality is you have rejected God. And you are experiencing, as the king of God's people, what God promised you would if you reject him. You, he says, are the troubler of Israel. And then Elijah sets up the contest. I want you to bring every false prophet you have. Bring them all. 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah. We're going to have a massive contest. If this was a Western, it would be calling Baal out to the street. We are going to have a massive divine duel, Elijah says, and we're going to do it right now. Now, God has decided that the drought has gone on long enough. Now there will be a definitive duel to declare who is the greatest. Who is God? Which leads then to section number 2, the fire. Let's begin reading in verse 20. So Ahab sent to all the prophets of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, "How long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people did not answer him a word. Then Elijah said to the people, I, even I only, am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us. Let them choose one bull for themselves and cut it in pieces and lay it on the wood, but put no fire to it. I'll prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood and put no fire to it. And you call upon the name of your God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord. And the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. They're happy to be a silent audience to God's self-created test. You notice, unwilling to commit, they are what Elijah calls them. They don't want to openly say that God isn't God. They claim a certain loyalty to Yahweh, but they don't want to defy Baal either. They're basically saying, you work it out amongst your divine selves. We're not going to commit one way or the other, which is exactly the condemnation that Elijah heaps upon them. Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose for yourselves one bull and prepare it first. For you are many and call upon the name of your God, but put no fire to it. Notice that the contrast is set all on one side. Elijah says, you go first. First of all, there's 450 of you. Now just imagine, this is a couple hundred people here on a Sunday, a few hundred people. 450 prophets of Baal are there surrounding one bull on an altar, and all that happens, all of these guys apparently are involved. It is overwhelmingly one-sided, and not just physically. Since Baal is literally the god of rain, the god of lightning, the god of the heavens, we could put it that way. He's the God that produces the fertility on the earth because he can provide rain, lightning, and so forth. It is as if God sets up the contest in Baal's own wheelhouse. He's like, here's what we're going to do. We're going to go to Samaria. We're going to gather all of your people. We're going to set up a contest in your area of expertise. It'd be like saying, look, we have two athletes. One is a boxer. One is a swimmer. And we're going to say, well, let's see who wins a boxing contest. Let's see who can shoot better than Steph Curry. Let's see who can swim better than Michael Phelps. We'll set it up in your lane. We'll see how that goes. All of this, culturally speaking, is on the one side. All of it is on the one side. Every expectation was, well, whatever else Baal can do, he definitely is the God of the heavens. Definitely. So he sets it up. These prophets in verse 26, they take the bull that was given to them and they prepared it and they called upon the name of Baal. Listen to this. Remember, 450 guys from morning until noon saying, oh, Baal, answer us. But there was no voice and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made. So this is apparently 3-4 hours of declaring. And Elijah's just sitting there watching. The passage is meant to have this increasingly awkward, painful. My wife says there's a word in Spanish for when you're embarrassed for somebody else and there isn't a word quite like that in English. I thought, what is the word? It's kind of like it was cringy. This is cringy. All right, this is the ultimate embarrassing moment. This is your wheelhouse. You're the God of lightning and rain. We've been shouting 450, not just a few of us, all of us, for 3 hours. And the commentary simply says there was no voice, no one answered. So the cringiness gives way to outright mockery. This is in keeping with what God says in Psalm 2, that those who defy him ultimately will be exposed as frauds. The absurdity. God speaks this way in the prophet Isaiah when he talks about the absurdity of idolatry, the absolute ludicrous nature of serving anyone besides God. It's not just that it's sinful, it's absurd. So Elijah represents that. He begins to say at noon after 3 hours, he mocked them, saying, cry aloud, for he is a God.
cry aloud. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened. Now again, mocking another person is not something we should do. I'm just making it clear. But what's going on here is he's mocking the utter impotency, the utter worthlessness of this so-called God. These people actually believed in Baal. This isn't making fun of somebody's jump shot or their clothing style. This is an actual false God that had led people astray, that they believed was real. And so he's just putting on display the utter silence that is attending this moment. He's saying, well, if he really is a God, if we give you the benefit of the doubt and assume he's real, well, maybe just having a real moment of indisposition, a real moment of weakness. Perhaps he's vulnerable. Perhaps he just has to be awakened. He's sleeping heavily. Perhaps, you see what he's doing? He's saying, this God that has so much power apparently can't even be bothered to answer his own prophets screaming at him for hours. He's displaying the absurdity. It's meant to come across as biting humor. It's meant to come across that way. Your God seems a little sleepy. He seems a little indisposed. I mean, it's been 3 hours. You're knocking on the door of heaven. No answer. The clear rhetorical question that grows in the passage is, perhaps there's no answer because there's no one there. They are unconvinced. So verse 28, they cried aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. They're so committed to this illusion of a Baal that will answer them that they will do anything, including mutilating themselves to draw his attention. Surely this, we'll do even more. We'll draw his attention this way. We'll show our devotion by our very blood. And as the midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But notice again, there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. Hour after hour. God has set this up so that there can be no doubt. Hour after hour. No one can claim, well, we didn't quite do enough. We didn't quite call enough. There weren't quite enough prophets. We asked him to do something that's not really his main thing. We didn't show our devotion enough. No, he's given them everything they could want. Every condition you could possibly want has been met, and hour after hour. If there was a God, Baal, he has allowed himself to be utterly humiliated. Then in verse 30, notice the contrast again. Elijah said to all the people, come near to me. And the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord that had been thrown down. Elijah took 12 stones, a reminder of their history, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob, to whom the word of the Lord came, saying, Israel shall be your name. He's reminding them that God claimed them for himself. Even the structure of the altar is a reminder. God claimed you for himself. And with the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord. And he made a trench about the altar. Notice, he's just going to set even more of a contrast. He makes a trench as great as would contain 2 seahs of seed. He makes a little ditch, and he put the wood in order and cut the bull in pieces and laid it on the wood. And then he says, notice this. God is committed to an absolutely certain revelation of who is the greatest. He says, fill 4 jars with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. And he said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. And the water ran around the altar and filled the trench also with water. This is not what you do when you're building a fire. This is not the fire building wisdom. He just dumps water. He says, nope, I want you to do it again. Four more jars, just dumped all over the... Do it again. There's water. The point here is that this is now a soggy, sopping mess of wood and cut pieces of meat, which, as you know, doesn't light very easily anyway. It's just sopping. There's water all around the outside of it, and he has no matches. He's not going to touch it. What's overwhelmingly clear is there is no physical explanation for what is about to happen. Zero physical explanation. And notice also the anticipation of what's to come, because water is extremely precious right now. How precious is water in the midst of a three-year drought? He takes jars of water, pours them three times onto the ground and onto the wood. He must know something's coming. He must know something's coming. And then, after it's sopping wet, he says in verse 36, at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near. Notice the simplicity of this prayer. O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and that I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me and this people, that they may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. Notice, who is the true God, and what difference does it make in your life? Then, notice, one prayer. I mean, you got to get yourself into this moment. They have been screaming themselves hoarse for 6 hours. They're bleeding. They're exhausted. They have just done everything. This is a sopping mess. One prayer after hours. One prayer. Then, verse 38, the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. It's a firebomb from heaven. Have you seen pictures of those kind of burnt out areas where there was some kind of artillery barrage, perhaps? God does that in this very isolated way. It is gone. The dust is gone. There was an altar there. It says it burns up the stones. It's a smoking crater of divine power display in an instant. And when all the people saw it, in verse 39, here is the climactic confession that it is meant to produce, they fell on their faces, what it means for your life, and they said, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. Overwhelming emphasis in this book, 1st and 2nd Kings, who is the true God, and what difference does it make in your life? And these people who were limping between two options, who didn't want to deny Baal, wanted to claim some historic allegiance to Yahweh, are convinced. They fall down. They declare the Lord, Yahweh, is God. It has been overwhelmingly proven that He is supreme over Baal. Baal, if he exists at all, has nothing on Yahweh. That's the point they're making. And so convinced are they that Elijah is able to say to them, seize the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape. And we see again and again the pattern of Scripture. You see this ultimately in the cross. You see this in the book of Acts. At their very point of strength, their efforts to destroy ultimately result in their own destruction. And they seized them. And Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. In keeping with Old Testament law, these false prophets are rightly executed. This has civil authority all over it. We don't have that authority today, but back then this was absolutely the right result for those who had defied God. In spite of all of their strength, in spite of their numbers, the crowd of people executes them. This fire is meant to reveal overwhelmingly that the confession of the people is true. There is one true supreme God, and it's not close. This wasn't a touch-and-go contest. This wasn't a split decision. This wasn't a buzzer beater. This was an annihilation from beginning to end. This was 9 million to zero. that this was absolute, devastating sovereignty. There has never been a contest in all the history of contests that was such an overwhelming display of supremacy as this one. And here's the point. The people leading up to this moment had actually believed there was a question. They came into this saying, it's even money. It's even money on this contest. Boy, the commentators were split. Yeah, I could go either way on this one. And at the end, there's the altar of the Baal prophets standing untouched. There's a crater and there's a slaughtered mound of the bodies of Baal's priests. Baal has been utterly, utterly defeated. Utterly defeated, and yet God is still not done. After it's been made overwhelmingly clear that he has control of the heavens, so that should he want to bring the rain back, there would be no question about who it was that was bringing the rain back. If there was a Baal, he would have done something now. Now that that's been made overwhelmingly clear, God has something else to do. Section number 3, the rain. And Elijah said to Ahab, get up, eat, and drink, for there is a sound of the rushing of rain. So Ahab went up to eat and to drink, and Elijah went up to the top of Mount Carmel. And he bowed himself down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, go up now and look toward the sea. And he went up and looked and said, there is nothing. And he said, go again 7 times. And at the 7th time, he said, behold, a little cloud like a man's hand is rising from the sea. And he said, go up. Say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down, lest the rain stop you. And in a little while, the heavens grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a great rain. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel, and the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he gathered up his garment and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. It strikes me as just a delightful indicator from God. After this overwhelmingly decisive moment, a single prayer, God sends fire from heaven. Elijah has to go and pray 7 times. And the first indication is a little cloud deep on the horizon. It's an indicator of something we'll see again next week and following, that though God has answered in decisive power, in general, it is still the season of faith. It's so interesting to me because we want it to be the case that all the answers are like the fire, and so did Elijah, and we find out later in the book, even the next chapter, that Elijah had an assumption that this is the end of faith. Faith is now over. We've reached a moment of sight. But no, God says, no. Even immediately, when you know there's going to be rain, you're going to have to pray 7 times. What's the difference? It's the same guy. He prays once and fire falls from heaven in front of a crowd of people, probably thousands of people. Now he has to pray 7. He prays and then he prays again. What's the difference? The mysterious sovereignty of God and the reality that this remains the season of faith. The season of sight is not yet. The same man sees abrupt and immediate answer, and then he has to endure in prayer. As he goes to Ahab, he tells him by faith, you better get going because you're in a chariot, and it's hard to drive when there's mud. There hasn't been rain for 3 years. There's no mud. There is no mud, okay? He's saying, listen, it's similar to Noah. There's never been rain. Listen, we're building a boat. Why? Well, this might be hard to believe. There's going to be so much rain that we're going to need a boat. He says to Ahab, You better get going. There's going to be mud. Why? Well, I saw a cloud this big on the horizon But at that point, even Ahab is willing to concede, well, I don't want to be totally defiant of Elijah. Clearly, there's some level of connection that he has. And then in response to this prayer, which we read about in James, we are meant to emulate this level of faith, because Elijah is just a man like us. A torrential downpour begins. And as if all of this weren't enough, as if the display of Ahab's weakness wasn't enough, God adds this final, insult to an abundance of devastation. Ahab literally runs in front of him all the way to the city. It's just like, just one more thing. Just one more thing. I'm faster than your horse. I mean, it's a delightful display of Psalm 2, God mocking the powers of the age that dare to defy him. You can't find me. You can't kill me. Your God can't stop the drought, send the fire, or start the rain. Even your horse can't outrun me. It's meant to display the utter impotency of anybody that defies God, ultimately. And their apparent strength in the meantime, God's people are meant to say, it is temporary, and it is God's restraint. As powerful a sign, it's worth noting, as the fire was in the larger context, the drought was killing the land. The drought was the ultimate display of the false religion of Baal. And now that Baal has been shown to be powerless, God, in utter mercy, sends the rain again. Ahab, as Baal's representative in the passage, is shown to be utterly weak, categorically defeated, zero on the scoreboard. That's what Ian Proven, the commentator, says. He says, from the moment Elijah meets the king, he dominates him. Ahab speaks once in the entire story, and having been silenced by Elijah's aggressive and fearless response, he spends the rest of the time either doing what the prophet tells him or watching from the sidelines so quietly as to be invisible. He is as impotent as the God he worships. Elijah's win over him is as comprehensive as his win over the prophets of Baal. The contest of gods here is absolute, definitive, categorical. Baal, the god of rain and thunder, can't stop the drought, can't send the fire, can't bring back the rain. Yahweh does all three. Elijah is alive. The prophets of Baal are dead. The overwhelming, passionate shout of the story on the lips of the people is, "The Lord, He is God." It screams through the generations and to us in this school building this morning, who is God, and what difference does it make in your life? Who is God, and what difference does it make in your life? And the pattern of this, remember, I think normally it's the case that in the Old Testament we should look for patterns. So I don't recommend normally looking for specific symbolic connections. What are we in the passage? Are we Elijah? Are we the stones that are consumed and sacrificed to the Lord? Is the Holy Spirit the fire from heaven? What exactly is? I wouldn't look always for those kind of specific connections so much as the pattern. What is the pattern here that we see fulfilled in God's ultimate story? Well, all of God's people, like Israel, have been cursed because of sin and stand under the drought of God's wrath. The powers of the day, of every day, and of our day, seek false gods, or at most claim to follow God when they really worship false idols. And don't we see that today in our country? The claim to follow God, along with a life that defies Him. Aren't there many that limp between those two opinions today? But in the end, in this story and ultimately, God will vindicate His glory. He will do this through the one that was crucified in weakness. Don't you see the apparent weakness of God's message and word in that moment when Elijah is surrounded by hundreds of false prophets, by people who will not choose to follow one or the other, who are ambivalent and distance themselves by a false king who is seeking to kill him? Don't you see the pattern that will ultimately and climactically be revealed in Jesus Christ? That though he was crucified in weakness, and in that moment, the diabolical shouts of evil were louder than ever, even on Mount Carmel. But he was vindicated. And as Paul writes, he triumphed over them, putting them to, listen to the irony of the statement, it's just like Mount Carmel, putting them to open shame by the cross. The very moment that's supposed to be Elijah's shame turns into shame for Baal and his followers. Just in the same way that the very moment that's supposed to be the shame of Christ is actually the open shame of his enemies. Because he is vindicated. And in the end, that one will reveal God's final vindicated glory when his enemies are condemned and utterly judged and his people receive the rain of his blessing poured out on them again. This passage is, it's just like a miniaturized snapshot of all of history. It's like a miniaturized snapshot of the moment in which we live. The prophets of God seem rare and few. The powers of evil seem mighty and passionate. The numbers of those who defy God or those who limp between two opinions seem overwhelming. And we live in the moment where we are waiting for the vindication. We've seen many singular moments, but we're waiting for the ultimate moment. We're praying for that moment to finally come. This moment is a snapshot of history. It's a snapshot of the greatest question of our lives. Who is the one true God? And what difference does it make for you? What difference does it make for you right now, this week, in the choices that you make? Who is the greatest? Who is supreme? Who is the one true God? And what difference does it make in your life if we believe this confession, the Lord, he is God. He is supreme. He, by his Son, though he was crucified in weakness, has revealed his ultimate glory, and we belong to him. We are his people, called by his own love. We belong to him. Small, yes. Insignificant, humanly speaking, yes. But we look forward to the ultimate vindication. Is that what you believe? Is that what we practice? There is one true God. He has ultimate and complete power. And our lives should be lived on our faces before him. What does that mean practically for us? Let me give you three examples and we'll close. If we believe this passage, it means we reject the false gods and the compromise of our day. We reject it. It means that on the crucial issues of our day, we are not like the people who gave no answer. Rather, we give an answer. What do you believe? The Lord, he is God. His word is true, and I will follow him come what may. We reject the false gods, and there are many false gods and compromises today. There are people who claim to be following Jesus and yet defy Jesus' word. There are people who claim to be worshiping themselves. The self-god Baal, if I had to pick one, the self-god is the Baal of our day. Self-identity, self-realization, self-centeredness, self-actualization. It is the Baal of our day, and we reject that as a God in favor of the God who is God. No, we are not our own God. We do not define our own life, our own future, our own purpose. No, God and God alone. We are meant to be his servants, to belong to him. God has made us for himself and not ultimately for ourselves. So today, Baal is not worshipped, but self is worshipped, and we reject the self-god that is the Baal of the day, And we reject the claim that you can worship Jesus and worship yourself at the same time. We reject. We consciously and imperfectly, but passionately reject the false gods and the compromise of our day. Secondly, we tremble at God's final judgment on his enemies. We tremble. This passage is just, it's the smallest little microcosm of the end of the age. It's God did it enough times in biblical history to prove that he would do it. The fact that he doesn't do it more is astonishing patience and mercy. That's the point Peter makes when he reminds everybody, there was a flood. This idea that, well, God surely doesn't care and he's become a little more indulgent in his old age. No, there was a flood. It wiped out everybody but God's people. This moment is a picture of the end of history. Those who defy God will perish. They will be judged. That phrase should cause us to tremble. It is true, and it will be ultimately true at the end. He took them to the brook and slaughtered them there. It should banish from our mind some thought of an indulgent, grandfatherly gift giver who is not a warrior against his enemies. It should cause us to tremble at God's final judgment. It should cause us to live in such a way that people come to us and want an explanation for why we're not living for this world. So that we can say to them, this world ultimately will end. I'm living in this world, but I'm not of this world. I'm living in this world to serve you like Obadiah did, but ultimately I fear the Lord. And I am not ultimately living for you, I'm living for him. Finally, we live by faith in God's final vindication in Jesus Christ. We live by faith, like Elijah had to. It took faith, after 3 years in hiding, being provided for by the widow, to come back, so to speak, into enemy territory, put himself in a vulnerable position, and say, go tell the king who's trying to kill me, I'm right here. Faith is needed in that moment. It took faith to say, I want you to call all the prophets of Baal. I want to be utterly surrounded. Utterly surrounded. I want a bunch of compromisers, and I want my avowed enemies right at the center. Faith. It took faith even after that moment to go up to the mountain and pray. God, I'm actually praying that you would cause the earth to work in such a way that there is rain after 3 years of no rain. Faith. It required faith. The one true God requires faith from his people. God has placed you and me in the time of faith. It's been true all the way back to Adam and Eve. It was highlighted with Abraham. It continued all throughout the journey of biblical history. It was revealed ultimately in Jesus Christ, who said, into your hands I commit my spirit. And then it continues in the church age. Faith. We live for something we don't see. You are called to faith, not sight. You're called to a final day when God will reveal his vindication. Maybe he'll do that in small ways throughout your life, but ultimately, his covenantal blessings won't be seen until he returns and sends them from heaven. Ultimately, the final justice on his enemies won't be seen. People will continue to suffer. We see it in the very next chapter with Elijah. After this incredible high point of ministry, he is immediately called to exercise faith. It is as if God said to him, yes, that was a gift, but faith is the need of the hour. What difference does it make that there is one true God? The difference is that you reject false gods and compromise, you tremble at God's final judgment of his enemies, and you live by faith in God's final vindication. By faith, not by sight. Because you believe there is one God and we are following him. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that you would infuse our congregation with faith. As we endure the screams of those who hate you, as we endure the pressures of those who are pressing towards compromise, as we endure the cultural call that your people are the troublers of the land, Lord, give us faith. Help us to reject the self-God of our age. Help us to live for the one true God. And Lord, thank you for the many moments like this moment on this mountain and ultimately like your resurrection from your sufficient death that, Lord, strengthen our faith for that day to come. You are the one true God. We confess you. We are your people. We belong to you, and we trust you for that day to come. In Jesus' name.